This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
If you're Malaysian, you've probably heard people say this. Indians are all gangsters and criminals. They are all alcoholics, drug addicts and wife beaters. But is this concept of the rowdy Indian criminal based on facts? Or is it a myth, consciously or subconsciously perpetuated to protect the status quo? I'm Darshan Johan and this is Today I Learned. I think it's important to start today's show by addressing the social ladder in this country, in which Indians are at the bottom. Indians often find it difficult to get jobs. I mean, even me personally, I once got fired because the boss said Indians will steal things. And Indians also find it difficult to rent rooms or rent places to stay. As Preeta Samarasan wonderfully wrote in an article on Mekong Review titled The Race Ladder, the ladder means that when three people walk into a room, an Indian and a couple of non-Indians, very different assumptions are made about each of those people based on their race before anyone can gauge their finances or their class before they even open their mouths. The question is, why are Malaysian Indians at the bottom of this racial ladder? Also, why is there even a ladder in the first place? I recently caught up with Mohan Ambike Parker. He's an associate professor in critical race theory and post-colonial studies. He said, to understand the plight of Malaysian Indians, we need to turn back time to an era of colonialism.
You have to look at the colonial and post-colonial history of the grouping that we call Malaysian Indians in Malaysia, which is, of course, a very complicated grouping. This is a racialized category where many different groups have been put inside. And in other situations, they may not have been put inside the same groupings. They may have been, you know, bigger fault lines between, say, Malaysians who are considered Indians, but are actually Sri Lankan Tamil, Punjabis and things of that nature. But we occupy a similar racial position categorization in Malaysia. But the vast majority of this category, of course, came through the labor migration process during the colonial period. But to understand why that even happened, you have to go back to understand colonialism as a whole. Colonialism not just in the Malaysian context, but colonialism as it occupied the British Empire globally, mm-hmm. right? And I feel that, you know, the story of the Malaysian Indians and the Malaysian working classes in particular, you know, starts with 1833. Right. 1833 is the date where the British Empire abolishes slavery. This, of course, creates a big problem for their capitalists, which at that time is centered around the plantation model. With the ending of the slave trade, you know, a big source of labor was cut off for the capitalists. They turned to the Indian indenture system, you know, to replace what they could do with slave labor. And this, of course, is the history of the Caribbean islands. You know, why is Guyana 50%, you know, Indian? Why is Trinidad 50% Indian? Why does south of Jamaica have Indian communities? Why does Fiji have Indian communities? Right. This all goes back, you know, to that period. And similarly, also, why does Malaysia have this community? It goes mm-hmm. back to this moment in history. The social conditions of the people who come to Malaysia, you know, start with this important point, right? That they are coming through oppression that has been created through the British Empire, right? And its need for racial capitalism, a capitalism that relies on the utilization of racialized bodies to perform labor roles. All kinds of issues came up. You know, they had to pay back their passage. They had to pay back whatever debts they would incur because the kind of rate of exploitation that took place and the setup for throwing the indentured worker back into a cycle of debt, mm-hmm. you know, was all very well designed, you know, and purposed to extract profit for the British Empire at the expense of denigrating this human being to nothing but that surplus that they could right. generate. All of it was to serve some of the most powerful capitalist interests in the world, literally to serve the Jeff Bezos and the Elon Musks of the time. So we are really talking about how Malaysian Indians were situated at the very apex of the capitalist process. Oftentimes we think like, oh, the British did us favors, the British gave us some nice things. But you have to really understand the depth of what colonialism did to the Malaysian Indians, right? Mm-hmm. How it situated them in the modern capitalist global economy.
Now, what I found fascinating is how inconsistent racist stereotypes always are. For example, if we were to assume that Indians as an ethnicity, as a race, are alcoholics, violent, lowlifes, then why is it that the stereotype, this particular stereotype, not exists in, say, the United States? There, the Indian stereotype is grocery store cashier, cab driver, nerdy comedic sidekick. This stereotype is also unacceptable. But the point is, it's contradictory. Are Indians violent criminals, or are we Apu from The Simpsons? The answer is we are neither. Interestingly enough, the Indian criminal stereotype is also a rather recent narrative in Malaysia.
When you think about the history we just talked about, there was no need for such stereotypes because those labor populations could be controlled. In fact, the main stereotypes were they were docile and happy to work in their pathetic conditions. Idea of Indian criminality, I think, begins to grow, you know, in the 1990s, 80s to 90s, you know, as working class Indian communities dealt another round of devastation with the fragmentation and conversion of estates and their eviction and displacement from what they had built up for about three generations into yet another starting from scratch situation. You know, they're thrown off these estates. Literally, in many cases, their homes are being demolished. They're given no compensation for their years of service. They're thrown into the urban, situation without capacity, you know, and then you begin to get the rise of so-called Indian crime in that context. And then the development of this stereotype about the Indian gangster.
A couple of things to note. Yes, among low-level criminals in Malaysia, a bulk of them are of ethnic Indian background. For example, a study by Science and Wellness Organization a few years ago found that 72% or approximately 28,900 of gang members in Malaysia are Indians. But think about it. There are 2.1 million Indians in Malaysia, which means that Indian, quote-unquote, gangsters only make up approximately 1.3% of the total Indian population of the country. So this stereotype, as stereotypes go, aren't actually based on anything factual. But more importantly than that, and this is something we need to highlight first and foremost, we need to understand why a percentage of Malaysian Indian population, however low that percentage may be, turned to low-level crimes and gangsterisms in the first place. And it really has got to do with oppression and a lack of socioeconomic opportunities, access to education, housing, during the colonial and post-colonial period we live in today.
So if you understand, you know, crime as a function of class, poverty, immiseration, and structural oppression, right? And you understand the police as targeting the working class dispossessed communities who are caught up in that socioeconomic and political struggle. In a book called The London Hanged, you know, when they looked at the in the 19th century, people who were hanged, given the death sentence, they were oftentimes poor people, a lot of times domestic servants who stole a plate, a silver plate, or silver fork or spoon and pawned it, you know, from their master's homes. And these people were given death sentences. So, you know, you want to go have a look at, you know, the scale of the crimes that we are talking about. Who are the people? What were their structure of opportunity? What were the marginalizations and discriminations of the communities that these individuals come from? And then you see the social crimes that are behind the individual crimes, right? But the policing function does not address the social crimes. It just goes after the individuals. You know, Usman Awang, the Malaysian, you know, literati poet, mm-hmm. You know, started his young adulthood as a mata-mata, you know, in his novel Tulang-Tulang Berserakan. In that novel, you know, he understands this point. He understands that when he is dispatched to spy on Malay left-wing nationalists, he understands that his function is to unleash state violence and surveillance on people who are dispossessed. Mm. And that's why he quits. We have this situation where we are throwing the police at problems created by socioeconomic and political marginalization, right? We should be throwing other kinds of responses. Now, in the sense that you have this disproportionate impact on a minority community, on the Indian community, also is reflective of the disproportionate ways in which that community is impacted by social crimes, the crimes of the structures of society, the crimes of all the policies that were done and not done in the colonial and in the post-colonial era. The Malaysian management, now no longer the white management, the Malaysian management never responded in its nationalist agenda to seeing the conditions of the workers as something that was a political issue that required redress.
Right.
It just talked about owning the plantations and putting the ownership of that plantations, the capitalist machine, into the hands of brown bodies.
Mm.
Right? Right. But did it conceptualize the nationalist agenda as redressing what were the conditions of the Malaysian, now Malaysian citizens and workers in those plantations? It was not an agenda item at all. So the boards become mixed. You got Chinese in there. You even have Indians inside the board. You have Malay CEOs and things like that. You know, like all now we have Malayanized the plantation sector, supposedly. But it's at the level of management and top brass that we have integrated and Malayanized it. We have, and we call that nationalism.
Mm.
Right? We haven't called the redress of the conditions of the working Malaysians in that situation, you know, a nationalist agenda. So repeated attempts to try to use the Malaysia plans to do something about this and to try to kind of get reform in the estate plantation sector, all are very weak-kneed and not incorporated at all, right? And it's almost like part of the nationalist agenda to make profits from the plantation is a nationalist agenda. So the more profits you make from the plantation and feed the economy, you know, you are doing a great thing with regards to Malaysian growth. But that is not being measured in terms of how people are being treated, whose conditions are not being alleviated by what the independent country is doing. And they are not conceiving of their condition as something that ought to be on the top of the agenda, right?
Yeah.
The course that we took in our nationalism, in our post-independence identity, in thinking that integrating the command part of capitalism was the nationalist agenda and not the conditions, you know, at the bottom around wages, around, you know, all of those kinds of sectors, especially in the plantation sector.
In other words, the various administrations in Malaysia has done more to protect the capitalist class and status quo than address systemic inequalities, which are designed to keep certain groups impoverished, which then leads to a lack of access or opportunity, which then forces people to engage in petty crime in the name of survival. All right, we are going to go for a very quick break now. When we come back, we continue our episode on the myth of the Malaysian Indian drunkards and criminals. We'll be back with more on Today I Learned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Today I Learned. I'm Dashrin Johan and we're discussing the myth of the Malaysian Indian drunkards and criminals. An acquaintance of mine actually once said, he literally told this to my face. You need to understand why many people don't want to rent houses or rooms to Indians. I've had experience in the past. They get drunk, they steal things, maybe even start a fight. Now, to these sorts of responses, here's what Mohan Ambike Parker, he's an associate professor in critical race theory and post-colonial studies, had to say.
Let's ask the same people this question. When you're dying from cancer, you're not going to go to the leading Indian surgeon in town? What about all the Indian doctors you have seen? Are they stealing from your wallets? So you have a psychological need to develop the stereotype about a particular group, which is, with stereotypes, there's always selective choosing, right? And selective creation of meaning. The argument that Indians have done contributions to the country, or even that, you know, they have played far outsized roles in things like medicine, healing people, taking care of people, or that they played far outsized role to the population in terms of politics and social justice. I mean, look at the social movements in Malaysia. You know, Indians have been at the forefront of contributing to struggles against discrimination and oppression in Malaysia. No one doubts this. I mean, everyone knows that that's the fact. So the question is, what is it about the need for this psychology of stereotyping that you have, right? Because of course, you know, when dominant social players are criminals, crooks, fleecing the country, robbing the country blind in amounts that far outshadow the entire 49 illegal gangs in Malaysia, right? It does not cast a similar stereotype on that particular community that they are from. They are seen to be individual crimes by individuals. Whereas here, the entire community has been put under collective suspicion. So this kind of dynamics, of course, we see in many other situations. African Americans in the US are also put in this kind of social position, right? Okay, you had a Barack Obama, but it doesn't take away the stereotype of African Americans as criminals. It doesn't take away the psychological, the social psychological need to equate dark skin with criminality, right? An African American is always already criminalized in the eyes of people. Then only they will adjust their opinions for that one particular case. You know, so Mohan, oh, he's okay. You know, Ashwin, he's okay.
Right.
Right. Once they have that input. So you're basically looking at something that has become embedded and taken hold as a psychological economy in society, right? It doesn't have correlation with logic, reason, empirical data. As I said, Indians have been using their black hands and skins to heal people in this country for generations and still are. These people who are racist will be begging for their lives to be saved by a talented Indian oncologist, you know, anytime, you know, if they could. They wouldn't see that person is going to steal from them. You know, but they might go back to the shop and not hire an Indian man because they have those views. So this is the way stereotype works. It's illogical, it's not consistent, things of that nature.
Now, this begs another question. Why would the powers that be maintain and perpetuate this narrative?
The way we have to understand it is like, what is the role that this demonization and folk deviling plays in the Malaysian psychological economy, right? Why do you need to have the figure of the Indian criminal? And you need to have the figure of the Indian criminal because the animus against that criminal will help to deflect from any considerations of all these structural things that we've been talking about. You know, if you were to go after the real criminals, go after the big time criminals, you know, who are looting and robbing the country, right? That is a difficult political proposition. So the psychology can adjust to looking at a vulnerable community that, you know, is facing serious socioeconomic dispossession, right? And understand that nothing has to be done with it so long as we can have this particular social stigma and animus that we have developed. We keep talking about the brilliant Indian doctors, And indeed, talking about the Malaysian plantation workers and their contribution to building up the modern economy, whatever we contribute will never break down the stereotypes, because the stereotypes are doing particular kinds of work in an unequal class-based, race-based system. They're doing work to maintain that system. As long as you can fob it off on the criminality of Indians, you don't have to address the structural injustices.
Something that many academics and activists have been talking about over the years, especially more so recently, is this very idea of crime itself, especially in a capitalist society. For example, during the Black Lives Matter protests in the US in 2020, many discussed the idea of defunding the police. Now, movements like these encourage us to think about this. What exactly is crime? What exactly causes crime? And how do we address it? Mohan is no different.
I think the question of crime itself has to be rethought. That is where I would say we should have the public discourse. You know, what is being criminalized and what is not being criminalized? I mean, we know for a fact, I think there are wonderful cartoons by Fahmi Reza, who's also trying to raise consciousness around these issues, right? So if you're a small fish and you steal a few razor blades or things like that, you know, you get a jail sentence. You know, if you remember the recent cases, we've had numerous cases where it was so blatant about the kind of heavy-handed sentencing that has been given to ordinary, you know, working-class Malaysians, you know, Malays, Indians, so on and so forth, who have been involved in relatively speaking, small-scale crimes. And then we find that that is criminalized, and that is also met with this social demonization, right? As if these kinds of crimes present the greatest threat to the well-being of Malaysians or the greatest threat to the economy of Malaysia. And you have other kinds of quote-unquote crimes that are not even criminalized, or not even criminalized in the same way. They're criminalized in ways that are like white-collar crimes, right? Which don't have to have the involvement of violent policing to address it. They are being investigated or dealt with. When you steal in the billions or millions, then you don't have police crashing down your door. You don't have police arresting you, throwing you into a jail cell and beating you up. It doesn't happen if you are involved in multi-million dollar or multi-billion dollar crimes. That's not criminalized in the same way. The criminalization there is like you are seen to have committed an administrative crime, right? You know, then, and even though the scale of your crime is so much bigger, the type of criminalization that the country does or the state does is quite different. The violent criminalization, you know, and the argument that these crimes require a violent response, right, or a response that deprives a person of social liberties and rights, and that is not something that will be utilized as a tool against a white-collar criminal, right? You're not going to throw a leading politician or a leading aristocrat or somebody who has decided to go into a gazetted forest area and strip it down of all its assets, thereby committing a public crime, right? But the police are not throwing those perpetrators of all of those crimes into jail cells and beating them. So the question is why? You know, it's a question of dua darjat, right? You know, if you come from the correct class, then your crimes will be dealt in a very different kind of way. The same thing, of course, happened in the United States. You know, when the bankers created the big collapse of the global economy in 2008, virtually no bankers went to jail, you know, for their crimes, as it were. And what happened? The entire country of the United States bailed them out. You know, I have a friend who was a vice president of Goldman Sachs, you know, which is one of the country firms that has been repeatedly involved in these high-level crimes, including the one MDB.
Right.
Right. And it was also similarly implicated in the 2008 financial banking crisis. Right. But in the years that they were responsible for these crises, and which often meant, you know, very serious consequences to the livelihoods of ordinary people who got demolished in this collapse. You know, my friend received, you know, a compensation package close to $1 million, which was paid for by the taxpayers. So this obviously causing the collapse of the global economy is not a crime. It's just capitalism, for which the ordinary people, taxpayers, have to flush out the cash to buffer your mistakes. So when bankers make mistakes, we respond by not throwing them in jail, not beating them up through interrogation. You know, how did you do this collapse of the global economy? You know, interrogation tactics that we feel are very necessary on a petty criminal, but are not necessary at all, you know, on bankers. If you are not moved by the fact that the level of crimes and so-called gangs, like to look into it, see who these individuals are. It's not the whole communities, the individuals, but also what were the social and structural issues that led to the need to be involved in these kinds of activities. The criminalization and collective suspicion of particular communities plays a very important role to uphold, right, the system as it is. It plays a great role. You know, this stereotyping of African Americans in the US society is very necessary to stabilize a very unequal, hypocritical system. And I would say the stereotyping of Indians does the same thing for Malaysia. It upholds a very unequal and hypocritical system.
That was Mohan Ambike Parker. He's an associate professor in critical race theory and post-colonial studies. So to sum up today's episode, now there are plenty of issues affecting the Indian community in Malaysia, but it's not due to the fact that they are Indian. It is not an quote-unquote Indian issue. It's a systemic issue, a system that is designed to marginalize some for the benefit of the status quo. But through understanding and solidarity, we can push back and hold the powers that be accountable. We can cause change. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Today I Learned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.